It's fun. It's wild. It's Dad's Gone Crypto.
Welcome back, crypto dads and enthusiasts, to a thrilling episode of Dad's Gone Crypto. Today, we do a deep dive into cryptocurrency security, and the burning question on everybody's mind is, can Bitcoin be hacked? And what will it take to actually hack it? So those are some questions. And obviously, there's the fear factor in it to say, well, if it can get hacked, all right, what do I need? All right, so it's a burning question on everybody's mind, and we're going to delve deep into it. So brace yourselves for a thrilling and mathematical episode of Hacking Bitcoin. Ryan, how's your week been so far?
Oh, not bad. We've getting things back to normal a little bit around here, but market is super boring right now. So
crypto is
super boring, but yeah, working on some things in the background. So hopefully we can have some fun here in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, true.
How about you?
Yeah, just busy this time of year. It gets a bit more crazier. It seems like every week just you're on this train that's getting faster and faster. But managing it, it's part of the journey. It's part of life. So we've got some cool things happening. So yeah, I can't complain. The Springboks, rugby lost against Ireland. I think it was tactical. We had to lose, otherwise we would literally play All Blacks in the quarterfinals. So if we lost, we play France, which is, I think, an easier path to the finals. So yeah, apart from that, it's been fun. Everybody's been in a festive party mood here in South Africa. So, and yeah, it's just been great.
Excellent. So you're accusing them of throwing the game so that they could get an
quarterfinals? No. when you don't play your strong players the whole match, you kind of let everybody just, you still a Springbok, let your less tactical players loose on the field. So yeah.
Letting them practice a little bit, huh?
Let them practice for the important upcoming games, exactly.
Excellent.
Exactly. All right, Ryan. So let's start off by, yes, you know, I think the majority of people kind of understand what Bitcoin is. But this is an episode, you know, you have to understand, truly understand what it is in order to delve into can it be hacked and should I buy some eventually, right? If it makes basically sense. So Ryan, what does Bitcoin mean to you?
Well, I mean, Bitcoin means a whole lot. It's why we're here. but Bitcoin, it's obviously at its basic form, it's a digital currency, digital asset. Store of value, if you will. So it's basically, in my opinion, it's like digital gold. Something that has over gold, over real gold, is that it's a completely limited supply. You know, they'll never be more than 21 million Bitcoins. The vast majority of those have been mined already. I think there's more of them, more than a million or maybe 2 million that are lost forever anyway. So, yeah. I mean, it's a very, very scarce asset where, real gold, there's, you know, we have no idea how large the supply of real gold is. I mean, it's mined every single day. So who really knows? But, Bitcoin is, you know, better than digital gold, in my opinion. It's also, you know, completely decentralized. So, Bitcoin is run, you know, on a vast network of miners, basically is, how transactions are completed. So it's decentralized. There's no individual company or individual person that, you know, that owns the whole of Bitcoin. It's a decentralized network. And part of the decentralization, you know, gives it, an absolute ton of security. Its blockchain is completely transparent. So every single transaction that's ever been recorded on the blockchain is still there and viewable for you to see. Bitcoin is really, is the future in my opinion. For me, the biggest thing about Bitcoin, it's really freedom, right? It's personal freedom from the legacy systems of our current world financial systems. Bitcoin gives us a decentralized way to hold wealth and to use wealth. So I think that's, to me, Bitcoin really, you know, the biggest thing, it just represents freedom.
And Ryan, you know, I often get this when we start chatting to newbies in the streets about cryptocurrency. And my dad's one of them. He's like, yeah, I'm sure he can afford a few Bitcoins, but he's like, I cannot touch it. He classifies it as funny money. And if you can't touch it, see it, you know, where does it go? Where does my money go? Right. So he's been collecting gold for many years. So you can touch it, you can feel it. You can skip country with it if he wants. Right. But with Bitcoin, you just can't understand the concept. And this, even the younger generation, they still can't understand that concept of, you know, decentralized. So what do you say to someone like that?
Sure. The older generation, you know, definitely is going to look at gold as a way more valuable, way more secure asset. Like you said, it's because they can touch it and feel it. You know, the younger generation, I think, looks at regular money that way as well. But, you know, when it all comes down to it, sure, gold, you know, I would say gold is a very good store of value. I'm not saying that it isn't, but at the end of the day, gold, you know, can still be manipulated in ways, you know, depending on how much is mined and all that kind of thing. And where its supply goes. And, really, I mean, you know, who's buying and selling it. And I mean, Bitcoin can in a way as well, but again, Bitcoin is very decentralized. There's no, you know, central governing authority looking over it. Like there is regular fiat currency. And that's where, you know, it's funny you say funny money, but in reality, Bitcoin is anything but funny money. You know, Bitcoin, we know the supply of, right? We know there can never be more than 21 million, where with fiat currencies, they're unlimited. I mean, you know, the Rand in South Africa or the US dollar. I mean, they can print as much as they want, and they've shown that they're not afraid to do it. They just continually print and print and print, which completely devalues the currencies and gives us extreme inflation. Where, you know, with Bitcoin, you know, we know that can't happen. So in my opinion, it is the absolute antithesis of funny money. I think it's the true money of the future.
That's right. And if you think about not just gold, but diamonds as well. I don't know if you've seen that Netflix episode whereby, you know, every 2 years, the next biggest diamond and then the next biggest diamond, the world's biggest. Meanwhile, they say they've got this vault of just big diamonds and they control the market and price so that, you know, that it stimulates, you know, the buy and sell and price. So if there was freely available diamonds everywhere, then the price would plummet and then everybody would have one. And then they can't control, you know, the market. So we trust that the diamond is valuable. We trust that the gold is valuable, right? But the amount that they're pulling out of the ground is massive amounts. But they can't tell you how much they're pulling out. My wife used to work for, you know, the mining company as a project manager, and tons and tons and tons of gold get pushed out, but it doesn't go into the market. So they're regulated and fluctuated. So we have to trust. Right. And now people in South Africa, we call this well, gutful. All right. Where we're frustrated about trusting, you know, the higher powers that be, like banking systems and the guys that control the diamonds and the golds and all of that. And we're looking for something better where the common man has a fair chance of playing in the field. And I think where cryptocurrency and specifically Bitcoin plays a vital role in that whole ecosystem.
Absolutely.
All right. So what is a miner? Since we're talking about mining and mining gold in that, what is a miner? How does it play? What role does it play with Bitcoin?
So, well, I mean, just like you just said, you know, gold miners, they're digging for gold in the ground, right? They're mining it. So that's how, you know, Bitcoin transaction validations basically got their name as miners. So, you know, I mean, basically their miners are running validator nodes that, validate and approve transactions. So, you know, I mean, because as we were just saying, you know, cryptocurrencies in general, they operate on a decentralized network, and there's no central authority. There's no bank that validates and approves individual transactions. It's done throughout that system of validator nodes. And that's what miners are. They basically ensure that transactions are legitimate. They make sure they're not duplicated. And that, you know, so there's no double spending. The cryptocurrency can't be spent twice.
And a node is basically like a very high end ASX computer or high end computer. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, basically in simple terms, it's a high end computer, or a high end processing unit that, that can, you know, manage these extreme numbers of transactions and try to solve the algorithm in order to, validate a transaction on the chain. So basically miners, you know, yes, they're validating transactions. They're securing the network. You know, Bitcoin has a vast number of mining operations out there, and basically they secure the network by the fact that they need so much energy to run so many, to run each of these miners. So basically they solve complex, mathematical problems, and it secures the networks against, attacks, malicious intents. Basically on any blockchain, and, you know, especially with Bitcoin, the more miners there are, the more distributed that blockchain is, and the harder it becomes for, you know, a malicious actor to take control of the network in any way. So, you know, I mean, that's the beauty of Bitcoin, is that its nodes are spread out all over the world, and there's so many of them that it would, you know, it, as we're going to talk about, you know, throughout the show here, it makes hacking the system very, very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, the other another main function of miners is the block creation. So, you know, we're talking about a blockchain, and basically once transactions are verified by the miners, they need to be added to the blockchain. So miners group a whole set of those transactions into a block, and then they add the block to the existing blockchain. It's a continuous process, and basically it ensures that the blockchain remains ongoing, and unbroken, so that, there's a continually recorded set of transactions. So like I had said before, you can, you know, you can find any transaction that's ever taken place on Bitcoin, on their blockchain. You know, another very important area is, the consensus mechanism, and basically, you know, this is what helps really secure the network. So, miners basically are achieving a consensus on the network. So, achieving a consensus of what goes on the blockchain. And it's in proof of work, which is where, you know, on, like, for instance, the Bitcoin network is run on a proof of work consensus mechanism. So basically miners compete to solve this mathematical problem. And, the first one to solve it gets to add the next block. And then they are rewarded in Bitcoin for that next block. And basically the competitive process is what ensures that there's agreement on the network about the sequence of events. So they're always competing for this, and it's always, basically putting out this, agreement that can actually be seen on the blockchain. And then basically, as I was saying, the reward mechanism is what incentivizes them. So, cryptocurrencies in general, but, you know, here we're talking about Bitcoin, they're designed to reward miners for their effort. So when a miner successfully adds a block to the blockchain, they typically receive a newly minted or mined cryptocurrency as a reward. And, you know, that, if you've heard of like the Bitcoin halving, it's, you know, around every 4 years or so, that reward gets cut in half, for Bitcoin miners. And it becomes more difficult to mine. So when this happens, the supply of Bitcoin, you know, gets basically the incoming supply of Bitcoin gets cut in half. And that's what, you know, tends to drive these, market cycles, after the halving to really fly up. So basically in Bitcoin and in any, you know, proof of work network, you know, that basically that's what compensates them for all the computational work and the energy costs. And it also, you know, it's how new coins are introduced into circulation. So it's an extremely complex idea that that was written in a very short white paper, the Bitcoin white paper, and you know, somehow has become basically what I would consider the most secure currency in the world.
And you think about the traditional banking systems, you know, every one of those things that you just mentioned, there has to be a human behind it or some technology that was written by a human that can be broken or manipulated or changed. So, and it's just ones and zeros. You know, often you hear about people just having like $10,000 in their account. It just appeared. How? How's it possible? All right. You quickly draw that out, but they chase you down. They're still trying to find me, Ryan. But, so there's a lot of, when humans create, there's a lot of room for flaw and errors. That's why a decentralized system of autonomy and consensus allows for a more robust, fools-proof system, and it keeps evolving. So I think that's where decentralization is going, to take those human elements out of it and make things more trustful, and, you know, you trust the systems better. All right, guys, so what happens when you send a Bitcoin to a friend? Okay, so what happens behind the scenes? So imagine you're like in a town square, right? So you want to give your friend Dave a golden coin, right? So you announce to the town, and you're walking over there and say, Dave, you know, instead of giving Dave directly the coin, you shout loud to everyone in the town, all right, Dave, I have some gold coins that I want to give to you, right? Or Bitcoins per se, right? So you're basically making a public declaration to the entire, you know, everybody in that area or to the entire network that you want to transfer or give some Bitcoin to another person, okay? So in that town square, you have ledger keepers and you have multiple ledger keepers and you're basically shouting out, hey, your declaration that I want to give Dave some Bitcoin. So they start writing it down. They keep these ledgers and they act kind of like miners for the Bitcoin network, and they record and verify the transaction. So in verifying a claim, before they actually can actually write it down, they might shout out, hey, do you actually have any Bitcoin in your wallet? Or do you have any Bitcoin, right? So now they have to go and check the records to see, do you in fact have Bitcoins? And they say, aha, all right, Sean actually has Bitcoin and therefore he can give it to Dave, right? So now they're validating. It's not just like I've got Bitcoin to give you and no one's got Bitcoin, right? You actually have to have it. So you have to validate it. But because it's a public ledger, everything that's transacted is transparent for people to see. Right. And that's why it helps the, you know, the validation of the transaction. So there's an agreement amongst the ledger keepers. So once the ledger keepers have written it down, the transaction happens, right? They compare notes and they say, yes, that makes sense. Yes, that makes sense. There's a consensus or the consensus mechanism in the Bitcoin network that, yeah, this is in fact correct. And then they agree upon that, and there's no funny business where you have some dodgy transactions, right? So that's where I think the consensus mechanism comes in. Everybody agrees that there's validation, that he wants to send, the addresses are cool. All right. So now what happens is you have to add it to the big book, right? So after they've checked and double-checked and the details to the coin, Dave gets entered into the book or of records, and then the exchange is made. So the analogy of the big book is basically the Bitcoin blockchain. So sealing the deal, finally, one of the keepers, after doing an extra bit of work and getting the nod from the others, so, you know, that's where the mining comes in, then the transaction happens, and they get rewarded for that work. So they were there in the town's square, they were chatting together to validate that he had coins. The transaction happened. Everything was fine. Now, that took some work, so they have to be rewarded. So there's a fee that gets, you know, placed on every transaction, and then the miners get that, right? So, you know, it becomes official, all right? It now said, I had once a Bitcoin. Now Dave has my Bitcoin, and it came from this address, right? So there's validation. It's not that you can just send it to nowhere, right? Whenever there's a transaction, the validation happens, it goes into the big book. The big book is there until death do us part, right? And even beyond that, right? So the aliens can even read it once in the near future. So that's kind of like a story of, you know, how it works in a very simplistic way. It's obviously more complicated than that. But yeah,
I like that though. I'm going to use that, the next time somebody asks
hey,
me
Dave.
What the hell Bitcoin is and how it works.
Hey Dave, what's Bitcoin, Dave? Don't sell your Bitcoin, Dave. We got this advert in South Africa about, some like men in pink drinks, Dave. Men don't drink pink drinks, Dave. We should do that for Bitcoin, men. Don't sell there Bitcoin, Dave. We're retired. All right. So let's dive into a theoretical scenario of hacking Bitcoin. All right. Because that's kind of like we want to find out. Can we hack Bitcoin? Can we make some money the illegal way? Or, and remember, this is not financial advice. and what would it take to actually, you know, hack the Bitcoin network? Because you need to know. Is it possible? All right. Right. So let's go through some theoretical breakdowns. The first one is you have to control 51% of the miners, right? Once you own 51% of that, then you can, you know, the concept. So let's put it in a barbecue concept, right? So think of Bitcoin as a barbecue contest. Everyone's voting for the best grilled steak. Now imagine someone in the group has over 50% of the votes. They could potentially sway the results, which you don't want, right? So, you know, in Bitcoin terms, the miner or the mining pool controls 50% of the network computing power or computational power. And, you know, they could double spend coins and prevent other miners from confirming the transactions. You're like, okay, wait a minute now. All right. So all I need to do is control the hash rate and 51% of all the miners in the world, and I can print billions and trillions of dollars worth of Bitcoin. I'm like, okay. So that's in theory 51%. It sounds plausible, right? But let's go a little bit deeper and see if it rationalizes out.
All right. So maybe we'll stick with your barbecue concept here and get into the next. So basically, you know, you got your 51% attack. The next way, I guess, would be like if you could actually break the cryptographic hash. So let's think about this with your barbecue example again. And let's say, you know, it's like trying to guess Grandpa Joe's secret barbecue recipe, which he says is unguessable, right? Yeah. There's a million different spices he could put in there. And we want to figure out exactly which ones those are. So we'll say that, you know, Bitcoin uses those, that secret sauce, the hashes, to maintain its integrity. So basically the idea behind, you know, breaking the cryptographic hash would be if someone were to find a weakness in the hash function, specifically the SHA-256 in Bitcoin's case, they could theoretically compromise the transactional integrity. But as of now, there's absolutely no way, just like there's no way to guess Uncle Joe's secret sauce, there's absolutely no way to break the SHA-256, at least as of now, that anybody has come up with. So, you know, I don't really see that one working out. I think Uncle Joe's recipe is safe.
Uncle Joe's recipe is very safe. All right. So, and then endpoint or wallet attacks. So endpoint meaning, so we're talking about miners. Think about that as the middle ground. That's, you know, you want to send money to Dave and Dave wants to receive money. But what happens in between? That's all the decentralized cool stuff. But you still have to put, you know, you still have to put your seed phrase in. You still got to put the code in. You still got to access your wallet. So we call those beginning and endpoints, right? And that's where you have to expose your credentials to in a fraction of time, secretly, of course, to the internet to allow that to happen, right? So you got a ledger wallet, or you have to write down your code using a browser. You're plugging it in. Yes, you're using a Brave browser and VPNs and stuff, but you're still exposing it, right? And that's what they're saying, that there's the concept is if it's maybe a little bit too difficult to compromise the midsection of it. So let's figure out ways to fize or to steal the beginning and ends, right? So that's kind of where that philosophy comes in, or the concept of like wallet attacks or endpoint, you know, hacking.
All right. So another one that has definitely attacked weaker networks, but basically it's called a Sybil attack. And I guess we can go back to the barbecue example again. So a Sybil attack, you know, the concept behind that. So imagine you're at a barbecue with all, you know, with all your buddies, and suddenly there's 100 fake guests, right? So now all of a sudden there's 100 fakes that, that you don't know. And it's all one mischief maker in there that, that somehow suddenly put these 100 fake guests in there, and they're totally messing up the party dynamics. You know, that's a Sybil attack. So basically in a Sybil attack, the attacker floods the network with fake nodes to intercept and manipulate network information. So Bitcoin now with Bitcoin, you're not going to really see this, because Bitcoin counters this through it's a trustless system where the nodes refer to the longest blockchain to determine legitimacy of it. So they couldn't just spring a whole bunch of nodes up like this with Bitcoin, because Bitcoin would see that the blockchain was too short. The nodes understand that, and they won't validate them. So
time jacking, it's another concept. So basically someone had to fiddle with like the barbecue contest timer, confusing everybody about when the steak will be ready. Attacker can provide, you know, a false timestamp of information to a node, impact the ability to sync directly to the network. So that's another form as well.
Right. And another one that that's known, you know, a known hack is basically a race attack. So a race attack, let's think about this in normal terms. So let's say two guys have basically the exact same barbecue sauce, and they're in a contest, right? But they're going to race to the judge and turn it in. And basically, you know, whoever gets there first is probably going to win, because if it's the best sauce, they got there first, the judge is going to taste it first and then think the other one's a liar, right? So that's kind of the how a race attack works. It's basically if a user sends two conflicting transactions into the network, and miners could potentially verify the fraudulent one, which would allow for double spending. So they approve the fraudulent one first, and then they race, you know, to get the other one in there before that one's noticed. And then basically a double spend could happen. It's been known to happen on, you know, immature blockchains, but with Bitcoin, I don't know if it's ever happened, but I know Bitcoin definitely mitigates this by using multiple confirmations. So like if you send a transaction on the Bitcoin network, you know, it's going to take at least, you know, 6 or 7 confirmations in order for that to happen. So that basically, you know, mitigates the risk of a race attack, because it would have to happen on 6 different nodes. So,
and this can happen because you're paying gas fees, right? And if you pay a higher gas fee, the miners are like, whoa, make more money, right? So you send the same transaction, one with the higher fee, you cancel the one, and then it's actually the fraudulent one that gets pushed through, because they're just validating. So I know it's happened on a couple of other cryptocurrencies, and it was a big thing. And you know, I think it happened on the Ethereum network, if I'm not mistaken. So this is just, you know, 6 examples of types of attacks that could happen. But to this date, Bitcoin has not been hacked. So these concepts have already been, you know, seen to and already been mitigated, and more, you know, but it's just nice to understand what potential attacks. And of course, the most important one would be your wallet attacks and your endpoint attacks. That's, I think, the most relevant one to the common user.
Right.
Yeah, all right. So the big question is, guys, you know, how many high end computers are needed to attack basically the security of Bitcoin, right? So if we go out and buy some computers, Ryan, can you raid the piggy bank? You need a very, very, very big piggy bank, like a World Bank piggy bank. And, you know, okay, so we've got the best graphics cards, we've got the best ASIC miners, we've got the best of everything. How many computers will we need to get that 51%? Let's go back to 51%. It's only 51%. I'm sure we can do it. But before we do a little bit of a mathematical, it gets a little bit technical, but I think we can, you know, stay with us here. But before we get to that, Ryan, just explain to us what exactly is a hash rate to our crypto dads out there.
So the hash rate, you know, as we were talking about miners, it's basically the hash rate's the measure of the computational power of the blockchain network. So hash rate is determined by how many guesses are made per second, basically. The overall hash rate, it helps determine the security and mining difficulty of the blockchain. So basically, hash rate is the measure of the power and the number of computations that are needed in order to, you know, basically put transactions through the blockchain.
In having said that, decentralized, and I think this is where the concept comes in, is that no single computer can hack that. You need a lot of computers in order to that. So the question is, all right, how many? So let's take the modern most advanced computer system that you can buy, good graphics cards, plural. Okay, so let's take it as, you know, the average modern high-end computer, all right, has 0.1 mega hashes per second. Okay, so according to ChatGPT, our good old friend, our buddy, our pal, all right, as of last year, 2022, the Bitcoin hash rate was 150 exa hashes per second. We'll get into what that means now. So remember, we're talking about 0.1 mega hashes. The Bitcoin network is exa hashes per second. All right, 150. It's only 150 exa hashes. Sounds very small. So let's do a little bit of math. All right. So one exa hash, right? So remember, 150 is the Bitcoin network as a whole. Now let's take one exa hash, right? Is one quintillion hashes. All right. So that's a lot of hashes. And as Ryan said, it's the amount of guesses per second that's needed to decrypt, all right, or validate. So, okay. So now we're talking about one exa hash is one quintillion, right? One mega hash is only a million hashes. So if we assume 51% of 150 exa hashes, that's 76.5 exahashes. Okay, stay with me. All right, so 76.5 exahashes is, bear with me, yeah, 76 trillion 500 billion megahashes. All right, so let's repeat that. 76 trillion 500 billion guesses per second. All right. So if one modern computer can handle 0.1 mega hashes, then it's 76.00000 mega hashes divided by 0.1, which is a computer, right? You need, are you sitting down? You need 765 trillion high-end computers, boom, in order to hack Bitcoin. All right. 775 trillion high-end computers to hack. All right. And then we did delve in a bit deeper. Can a supercomputer, can quantum computers hack Bitcoin? It's different languages, it's different algorithms. They're calculating in different ways. So there's no quantum computer to date, and there's 500 in the world that has enough power to hack Bitcoin, right? So Even in the future, things are going to get more technical and more harder with the halvings and that. So it's going to get, you know, harder to crack those codes. So it's always a step ahead. So that's why guys like Michael Saylor, you know, can put Bitcoin on their financial microsystems balance sheets and own billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin because they feel safe about this. And, you know, they're mega whales in the space. And even Michael Saylor, in his personal capacity, you know, truly, truly believes in this revolution of Bitcoin because it has not been hacked to date. And if memory serves correct, just go ask any banker, has your bank been hacked before? Quite possibly multiple times.
Yeah.
Right. So Ryan, knowing this new information, all right, I doubt you have enough money yet to buy that many computers.
Probably not, unfortunately.
Do you think Bitcoin is hackable?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
No, I honestly don't think there's any way that Bitcoin's hackable. And part of it, just like you said, you know, quantum computing and all this, you know, can a quantum computer take the place of 765 trillion high-end computers? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, so and even as quantum computing becomes more and more quantum computing, there's more and more quantum computers in the world. Even at that point, the energy that a quantum computer takes to run is so much higher than a regular computer. I don't think there's enough energy on Earth in order to even use quantum computers to crack crack Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, you know, Satoshi was really clever when he basically, you know, put this algorithm together, because as Bitcoin ages, as you know, every 4 years, as that halving reward gets cut in half, it also basically doubles in difficulty to solve these problems. So yes, as quantum computing gets better and better, you know, maybe they get closer to that mark, but Bitcoin continually gets harder and harder to hack. So I think Bitcoin's going to stay ahead of the curve. And yeah, I don't see Bitcoin ever being a hackable asset.
Yeah. And I was reading a bit more on the quantum side of things. And, you know, in order for transactions to happen, there's noise that happens within the algorithm. When there's noise, the calculation has to be redone. So you have to have, smooth computational algorithms. The minute there's any noise, it makes the cracking of the code even harder, because they have to restart and do it again. And the other thing with quantum computing is that it will be easier for quantum computing to be let loose on the internet, right? And when you unlock your wallet, plug your seed or your seed phrase into a browser, into the transactional thing, and you've done that multiple times, then quantum computing can kind of can probably crack that code easier than it can. Well, it can't crack Bitcoin, but it can crack it easier than that. So the more times you expose your Bitcoin transaction wallet to the internet, the better chances quantum computing have a chance of hacking it. That's what I read. So
right.
You would probably need to, you know, set up multiple different wallets, you know, when you're transferring. And once you do it once and then transfer it again, and another one, but that's another story.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one way around that too is just using cold wallets. I think cold wallets are going to become more and more, I mean, they're already very prevalent, but I think it's going to become more and more prevalent as you said, as quantum computing becomes a real thing, because, you know, if you're not connected to the internet, they really can't get you. So
yeah, exactly. All right, guys. So that's our take on Bitcoin. Is it hackable? No, it's not. But there are loopholes in the system where, you know, obviously they can, you know, if you're not looking after your wallet, you're not using secure computers, not using VPNs, those type of things, then yes, you know, your money and your Bitcoin can be stolen. And that's why we'll probably follow up with a security version of how to protect, you know, your assets in a later episode. But now it's this time of the show, guys, where we have Dad's Got Jokes. Ryan, do you have an awesome joke for us?
Sure. I'm sure I could come up with something here. You ready?
I am ready.
This guy tried to sell me a coffin today. I told him that's the last thing I need.
I like that. I like it. All right. So my wife asked me the other day to sink her iPhone. So I threw it in the ocean. I don't know why she's mad at me.
Oh boy.
That's great. Dad's jokes. we just get fined for it. Is that whiskey? Just drink it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, fun.
All right, guys, and that concludes our episode on Bitcoin today. Thank you for joining us. Please visit our Telegram group. We've got some exciting things happening in there. Dad Sacks will be launching soon. We're busy working on the back end to get that gamification going, which will be quite cool. And don't forget to comment and like and share the video, please, guys. We appreciate it. Tell all your friends, and we'll see you next week for another good episode on Dad's Gone Crypto.
See you, guys.
Ciao.
The material and information presented in this recording are for entertainment purposes only. Do not misconstrue what you hear as investment or trading advice. Always do your own research. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed by the guests on this recording are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Dad's Gone Crypto or its hosts.